You're listening to A Week in Wireless by telecoms.com, the podcast dedicated to everything and anything going on in the telecoms biz. On today's A Week in Wireless, we go over the mammoth acquisition of Arm by SoftBank. We have a look at Q2 results for some of the industry's biggest vendors. We examine some of office workers' habits on social media. And we end with a little bit of Pokemania. All that and more on today's A Week in Wireless. Do you want to join the argument? Tweet us at telecoms. Hello and welcome to A Week in Wireless, the podcast brought to you by telecoms.com. My name is Tim Skinner and joining me today, I'm going to switch it up, it's Scott Pacino.
Oh, me first. Hello.
Hello, Scott. And oh, it's Jamie Davies. How you doing, Jamie?
Hi there, Tim.
Lovely. Okay, guys, so this week we've got a bit of a packed schedule, so let's get moving, shall we? Scott, you wrote this up, so why don't you go into a bit of detail about SoftBank's £24.3 billion acquisition of Arm.
Okay, so Arm's company are quite familiar with, both from this job and previous lives. Mm-hmm. It's almost certainly the most significant UK tech company. And what it does is it designs microprocessors, designs the chips, doesn't make any. It's not like Intel or Qualcomm that make the chips. It just designs them and then it licenses those designs to people like Qualcomm, people like Apple, mm-hmm. people like Samsung, all these guys. Basically, pretty much every chip that is in a mobile phone contains probably several designs mm-hmm. from Arm, because they don't just do like the application processors that we use to run the games and all that, but they do the modems, chips for the modems, and the processing of sort of codecs and all this sort of clever little embedded things.
So I was about to ask you then, what would we know Arm for specifically? But you just said several components in every phone that you'll see. Pretty much.
Yeah. And you know, but they're very understated. They're very English in that mm-hmm. way. They're very understated. I met both their previous CEO and their current one, and they're both just sort of understated engineering type of guys.
Yeah.
And that's also deliberate, because Arm doesn't want to be the story. Arm wants its customers to be the story: Apple, Qualcomm, Samsung, etc.
Yeah.
So that's what they do, and they've been quietly doing that for a while. What a lot of people might not know is Arm was originally created in part by Apple, because Apple tried to create a predecessor to the modern smartphone called a PDA, and theirs was called the Newton, the sort of handheld.
Right.
And it was just ahead of its time in terms of, you know, they couldn't make it cheaply enough, there wasn't the demand for it. But they kick-started this process of how can we make chips that are really low power, really small and low power.
Mm-hmm.
So typically Arm is compared with Intel as Intel being really powerful, but on the sort of energy sort of profligate side, it uses a lot of energy. So it's great for PCs, great for servers, great for anything that requires a lot of muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And Arm's generally considered to be better for something where battery life is paramount and where low heat production is paramount, like a smartphone. So that's what they do. And SoftBank is primarily an operator. They're a Japanese mm-hmm. operator, and they also own Sprint in the US, which is a massive acquisition, another massive acquisition a few years ago.
They have a big stake in Alibaba as well, is that right?
That's right,
The Chinese e-commerce.
But they've just been selling some of that, as well as selling a game developer that I can't remember, Clash of Clans, one of those big sort of games. And one of the reasons they're doing that is to free up all this 24.3 billion quid.
It's a fair bit of wedge.
To buy Arm. And one of the reasons it surprised people have been wondering about Arm being acquired for a while, because it's a successful company.
Yeah.
And because mobile's such a big deal. But there were rumours about Apple buying them and that sort of thing, but it wouldn't make too much sense for someone who already makes chips to buy Arm, because the competition authorities wouldn't allow them to stop licensing this stuff to their competitors.
Right, yeah.
So all they'd end up doing is getting ownership of stuff they already license. So it wouldn't necessarily make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
What this guy, his surname is Son, Mayashi Son, something like that.
Okay.
The CEO and the owner of SoftBank, he's a sort of visionary, he's a big picture guy.
Yeah.
He likes to buy into things for what they're going to be in 10 years, not for what they're going to be next quarter.
Right.
And he just thinks IoT, along with pretty much everyone else, IoT is the next big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Arm's the best company at embedded silicon, i.e. the smarts within IoT.
Yeah.
So by buying Arm, I'm going to put myself right in the middle of IoT.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that's worth £24.3 billion.
And Arm already runs, is it the Embed IoT platform and ecosystem that they've been developing?
So another thing Arm tries to do is to support its partners through software development, through helping them at fabs, which are the incredibly complicated factories where silicon chips are made.
Right.
So it does all sorts of ecosystem stuff as well to try and stimulate demand for its designs.
If I recall correctly, did you not take a trip to one of these factories?
Many moons ago.
Yeah, it was a company called Global Foundries, which it used to be AMD, and then it spun off its foundry bit.
Uh-huh.
So it's Global Foundries. Yeah, and I had to dress up in what looked like a sort of biological warfare suit.
Wow.
And walk around. There are all these machines. It apparently costs tens of billions of dollars to equip a fab.
Wow.
And you know, there'd just be machines that, you know, that did something incredibly clever, and each of them would be hundreds of billions of pounds or
good
dollars.
God.
So yeah, it's an expensive game, and these people are all reliant to some degree on licensing designs from this little Cambridge company.
Right.
I've been to their HQ, interviewed their CEO a little while back, and they're right next to a field.
Right.
You know, even their location is understated.
Mm.
But here they are, right in the middle of all the most exciting stuff that's going on in tech.
So does this mean that Arm will now become SoftBank, or they continue the brand Arm because it's so well known in the industry? You know, do we know much about what SoftBank intends to do?
Yeah,
with Arm?
So the structure right now is that SoftBank in Japan operates by itself. Sprint operates by itself. SoftBank does have some other interests, like distribution, and one or two other bits and bobs. So it's sort of one of these more sort of typical Far Eastern conglomerate type of things, like Samsung or LG, where they've got interests that don't necessarily directly overlap.
Yeah,
and I think the big way in which the SoftBank boss was pitching it is Arm is currently a public company, so it's got to worry about placating shareholders every quarter.
Yeah.
When I buy it, they can just look at the big picture and they can worry about 5 years down the line, not 5 minutes down the line.
Yeah.
So that was his vision for it. But, you know, that's a lot of cash he's putting down. He said himself, well, in terms of the multiple of their profits, you know, he'd have to... It'd be about 10 years before he even sort of saw his money back.
Mm.
So he's got a ramp. It can't just keep going at the level it's going now.
Yeah, quite. Yeah, so one of the things that we did see that was quite humorous around this is sort of, let's say, call it myth-busting over the rumours of SoftBank buying Arm, because it's a British company and we've just voted for Brexit, as we all know.
Yes.
I hear that he received a few questions saying, so what about the timing of this? Have you only bought Arm now because the pound's weakened?
Exactly. No, I listened to the press conference and watched it streaming on the internet, and yeah... A lot of the journalists had decided that was the story.
Mm.
That he's only buying Arm because it's on the cheap
post-Brexit.
And, you know, personally, I thought that was a bit of a weak angle, because if you look at what's happened to the pound, let's say compare it to the euro, it's dropped by about sort of, I don't know, 10% against the euro or something like that post-Brexit, and it's recovered a little bit of that ground. It's probably been a similar drop against the dollar and other international currencies.
Yeah.
So, okay, so let's say he's saving 10% on the share. Is that the reason to buy it? And the guy pointed out on the call that the actual share price of Arm's gone up by 15% since Brexit anyway, so there's no saving there. But it didn't stop lots of people asking the question. I think by the end of it, he was starting to get a little bit tetchy on it.
Yeah, understandably so.
I mean, I don't think it's going to have... I mean, obviously, Brexit is going to have an impact.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I've been saying this for weeks. On our day-to-day lives... Things are going to be a bit more expensive. Things are going to be a bit cheaper. You know, it's not going to have a huge impact on us. And it's quite interesting you bring up about people getting a bit naffed off with this Brexit comments, because I've been going through the quarterlies this, and I've been making notes of every time Brexit has come up in a conversation. And the IBM one was quite an interesting one, and I've copied and pasted it here. And what Martin Schroeter said, I don't think Brexit's coming at the end of the quarter helped us at all. But then he actually goes on to say, yeah, we don't think it helped, but it didn't cause us to change our guidance.
Right.
It happened, but it's not had an impact.
It's a thing.
Yeah. It hasn't changed what IBM are forecasting. And then, you know, VMware said exactly the same thing.
Right.
There was a Spiceworks survey which showed spending is actually going to decrease over 2016 in Europe, whereas it increases in North America. So that's one area it's had an impact. But then you look at the SoftBank Arm thing, not an impact there. F5 said they did. It's not a huge impact either. I mean, it's not...
It's hard to tell as well. You know, we all know, and we've touched on this in previous podcasts, and here in the UK, we're right in the middle of it. Immediately after the vote, there was lots of hysteria. There was lots of wailing and gnashing of teeth. And I was out about a week ago with a mate of mine for his birthday. And after we had a few drinks, things got a bit heated. And honestly, I've never seen it. This is the sort of thing that that sort of pitches brother against brother and splits families, and you know, there's schisms over it. But I think people already, it's starting to calm down a bit, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we had hysteria, our fun, didn't we?
Yeah,
we had our moment where the whole world was looking at us and we were just tearing ourselves apart, and it was all a bit humorous. But I think it's starting to plateau a little bit now.
Yeah.
So I don't think we need to dwell too much on the. So before we move on, then I'm just going to touch upon a couple of things that just came to mind while we're talking about this. Then, so we've seen the £24.3 billion, $32 billion acquisition of Arm by SoftBank. We saw Dell acquire EMC for $60 billion.
Still in the process.
It hasn't been finalised yet. But it initially started off as $67 billion.
Uh-huh.
And then since then, I mean, I haven't looked at what the actual value of it is now, right, but I think it's fluctuated.
It's dragging on a bit, isn't it?
At one point, it was down to $60 billion, right, and I think it's gone up. Well, I mean, they're going through their integration period at the moment, and I was at EMC Worlds a couple of months ago, and there was actually a great little presentation where you have the guy who's in charge. I can't remember the names off the top of my head. I think one of them was Rory Reed from Dell, who's in charge of the integration from that side. And I think it was Howard Elias from EMC, who was in charge of integration there. And they just said, you know, you're merging two of the biggest tech companies in the world.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen overnight.
Right.
But I think their zero day is, I think, Q3, don't hold me to that, but I think it's coming up.
Okay.
It's not too far away.
Okay, so then there's that, and then Microsoft bought LinkedIn for $26 billion very recently, which we've covered extensively.
Yeah.
Last year we saw Nokia acquire Alcatel-Lucent. Yep. Everyone knows about this, for another $12 billion. So we're seeing monumental, eye-watering amounts of cash going into essentially consolidation.
Yeah.
Scott, in your experience, or Jamie, in your experience, have either of you guys seen this sort of consistent level of high value, high impact acquisition going on in the industry?
I think you do. It tends to come in phases. You know, for some people who can remember back to the dot-com bubble, everyone was just chucking money around like confetti then.
Right.
Until the bubble burst.
Well, there's the fabled, is it Verizon Wireless buying AOL, was it?
No, that was Time Warner.
So Time Warner, thank you. Yeah, sorry.
So yeah, exactly, and that was the archetypal dot-com bubble, sort of over-exuberant bit of M&A. So it does happen. You know, in common with the two of you, I've never sat at the top table at a large multinational company, so I don't really know what they think.
Otherwise, to this dark studio in a grey building in London, that's some mighty fool.
Quite.
I mean, I don't think it's the end of it either. I think.
No, well, I was just going to say, Jamie, I'm guessing, even though I haven't been in that room, that sometimes they just think, what are we going to do? You know, organic growth's all right, but it's not really doing that much. What can we do to make things happen? And often it ends up being M&A.
Yeah. I think it really demonstrates how much the technologies that we're seeing come into the forefront now, it's really shown how much that is changing the digital economy. And, you know, these huge acquisitions, they come about because technology has gone beyond the reach of a lot of these organisations. You know, we're going to buy instead of grow organically.
Yeah. So should we move on at this point, unless you have any further thoughts?
I was actually going to sort of steal your thunder by exploiting that natural link anyway myself.
Right. do you know what? You host. Go right ahead.
Sorry, mate.
No, I'm going to have a huff.
You know, we're going to talk about Q2 earnings season, which has just kicked off this week. And one of the things that occurs to me, so we talk about Microsoft and LinkedIn.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll hand over to Jamie because you've been covering those. But, you know, Microsoft's doing all right.
Yeah.
But most of where it's doing all right is through organic gradual change, the transformation from a software vendor to a cloud player, rather than from all these massive acquisitions. And we know the Nokia acquisition was disastrous for Microsoft. So, you know, I'll hand over to you, Jamie, but, you know, just leaving that thought that sometimes M&A isn't the best way.
Yeah, but I think that one's been a long time in the building.
Well, that's it.
Yeah.
It takes a while.
I mean, how long has Microsoft been in the shadows? And it's in the last couple of years. You know, they were the biggest, most recognisable company in the world. And then Apple came along and you had those hilarious adverts where, you know, I'm a PC, I'm a Mac.
Oh, yes.
And it just showed that...
Was that Mitchell and Webb? In the UK, they did those,
Yeah, and I think that just shows how much off the pace Microsoft was then. So they've been building and building and building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've used a phrase, and I'm pretty sure I've read it somewhere, actually, when I was covering the Microsoft quarterlies yesterday, was that they're on route to become a mega vendor. And it's something I mentioned.
A mega vendor. Love that.
And I think it's just...
Sounds like a transformer.
Well, yeah. Well, for me, it's a company...
Turns from a robot into a CD. Yeah.
I mean, for me, it's a company that has its finger in every pie. You know, like the LinkedIn. We were talking about LinkedIn a couple of weeks ago on this podcast.
Yeah.
Are they doing that so they can get themselves into the social game? And then all of a sudden, you've got Microsoft... doing clouds, doing servers, doing database, doing social, doing they're in everywhere, and it makes it so difficult to get away from Microsoft when you want to buy somewhere else. Mm. So that for me, their transformation has worked.
Yeah, fair enough. And we're seeing this sort of strategic realignment for some of the major vendors, and because it is Q2 results coming around at the moment. So what have you guys, before we end the first part then, what have you guys been seeing with some of the quarterlies? We've had Ericsson, Scott, you spoke to their CFO recently. We've also had IBM, Intel, Qualcomm, Microsoft, et al.
Okay, well, quickly, the ones I've covered this week have been Ericsson and Qualcomm. Ericsson, they've been in a similar situation for a little while where they're sort of, their numbers are ticking along, but they're not growing in the way that people would like to see. And that puts pressure on the people at the top. But, you know, when I spoke to CFO, he was just saying, look, I'm not going to lie to you, the trading conditions aren't that great at the moment. We've just got to hunker down. We've got to keep going along, and you know, and until the next sort of big cycle comes along. And that was their one. Qualcomm, by contrast, you know, that was just today, which is last Thursday, if you listen to the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
or even longer if you're listening way in the future.
Yes, if you're listening on Dave.
Yeah. No.
And they're doing pretty well. Their stock went up about 8% in pre-market because they got some nice numbers, and they're really positioning themselves strongly for 5G. Or at least claiming to be. So that was my ones. What about IBM and Intel? How are they looking, Jamie?
I mean, IBM, I'll concentrate more on Intel because that was today or last week. IBM, they're doing pretty well. I mean, you know, Big Blue is seen as one of the big legacy companies now, but you know, cloud and data, I think, is accounting for 38% of the business. So they're creeping there. They're creeping there. They're slowly compensating for the legacy business.
Okay.
Intel, they got a lot of stick today. I think, you know, a lot of people, you know, are saying this, they're way off expectations.
And,
you know, I looked at it, I thought they were okay. They didn't grow as much as they should have done.
Or was expected.
But I should drop Brian Kazanich a line. I'm sure he'd love to hear from you.
But at the same time, you know, 3% growth when you're going through this transition period.
Yeah.
It's not that bad.
I think he'll use that. I think in the next earnings call, when people go, look, Entor bloke, why aren't things going better? He'll go, look, Jamie says I'm all right, so shut up.
They're doing okay.
Yeah.
You know, they took a lot of unfair flack today, I think.
I think that's... On that cheery note, it's a good time to go to a break, so stick with us. We're going to come back with a bit of mobile gaming and a bit of chat about Pokemania.
On the next episode of A Week in Wireless, we'll be bringing in our very first guest in the telecoms.com studio. Mary Clark from Cineverse will be joining the gang to talk about the latest trends in the industry and what the future might look like for the telcos. Join us next week for another special edition of A Week in Wireless.
Hello and welcome back to the second part of today's A Week in Wireless. Thanks very much indeed for sticking with us, listener. So, first part of the show, we talked a lot about M&A and some quarterly stuff, but let's liven things up with some sort of mobile gaming stuff. It's week two of proper, full-on, cataclysmic Pokemania. So Pokemon Go, for those who just haven't come across it, or for people like Jamie, don't have a smartphone. every week, Jay. Pokemon Go was launched last week in the UK and around the world subsequently, or before that anyway. And EE kicked off by saying they experienced some record downloads, I think it was, of the application. But we've just been seeing the world go crazy for this app, for this game. So, I mean, who fancies chiming in? Because there's so many different things we can talk about here.
I can talk about sort of first impressions. I downloaded it in the name of sort of journalistic rigour.
Yeah.
And I was playing it, and then And you know, it's actually very simple. All it is it's a sort of geolocation-based game where if you walk around, every now and then you bump into a sort of electronically superimposed Pokemon.
Yeah.
And then if you click on that, then your screen turns into an augmented reality screen where you've got the normal sort of real-world background behind you with a little dude, electronic dude, and you have to chuck a ball at it and catch it.
Yeah.
And it's the very simple gaming sort of dynamics that there's always been with Pokemon way back to the 80s, which is about collecting.
Yeah.
It's about sort of generating demand and generating this need to collect these things that you previously couldn't care less about.
Yeah.
And so that's what's clever about it, but it's actually quite rudimentary.
Can I chime in there for a second?
Yeah, yeah.
Would you actually call it proper AR?
Because well, that's the very debatable, yeah.
It doesn't interact with anything in the environment, doesn't it? It just sits
there. It's an overlay.
I think it's more of a GPS game. It's the GPS part of it where you've got stuff superimposed on what is essentially Google Maps.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's the main part of it. The AR is just the final bit where you happen to encounter one of these things.
But
it's not proper AR. I totally take your point. I don't think it is.
So we saw EE, Experience Record Downloads. I think you wrote that up on telecoms.com last week, Scott. It's already, I believe, had more downloads than the Twitter application. and it's not even launched in Japan yet.
Yeah, it's the daily use. Those are the big stats, is the average daily use.
Right,
it's
okay,
just people are spending more time on it than they are on Twitter. I think possibly only Facebook is higher than it.
Right, okay, so that's a pretty impressive stat already. And it's not even launched in Japan yet. It's home market. They've put off the launch in Japan because McDonald's, there's quite a big difference between the two, isn't there? They apparently allegedly leaked some launch rumours about Pokemon.
Yeah.
And so Niantic or Nintendo or whichever kind of pushed back the rollout. But you got to imagine, that's going to go crazy. And then also, Japan is, we discussed this a little while ago, massive on in-app purchases.
Yeah.
So
see, that
what do we expect when it kicks off over there?
That, for me, is the reason they pushed it back. Because we've seen server crashes
in every
country that they've opened to. So,
but this isn't a new thing. This is endemic. For every major online game that launches, people will flood to go and play it. And then for the first week or more, you have glitches.
100%.
And I think, actually, I want to get this in there because I'm really proud of this. The slogan for Pokemon is, got to catch them all.
Yeah.
With the server problems they've been having, they should probably patch them all.
Do you know what I mean?
And I'm done.
Yeah.
But I think that is, that's the reason. I think everywhere else in the world, they were perfectly happy to ride the wave of their not having enough capacity or their servers crashing. But then all of a sudden, you throw in the idea of, well, you've got the Japanese market, which is notorious for spending loads of money in app.
Yeah.
That's when you don't want your servers
to
crash.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
You know, Canada, they spend no money in game purchasing. You know, okay, if we piss off a few people there, we're not really that bothered.
Yeah, right.
They're not going to stop playing the game. But then in Japan, when they're spending money,
I think you're spot on. Last Sunday, my kids, I got a 12-year-old, 9-year-old, and I thought, let's the three of us go out around my hometown and catch some Pokemon. And we were all just having a nightmare with the server. My daughter, in the end, just went, I can't be bothered, just buy me an ice cream, Dad. you don't get the server crashing on an ice cream. There's a certain sort of analog sort of reliability about that.
Yeah, quite.
I think you're completely right, Jamie. It's all very well riding the crest of the wave, this incredible publicity. Everyone's jumping all over it. We're getting press releases every day, spuriously linking to Pokemon Go. And so they don't want to waste that publicity, but at the same time, if they give people a really rubbish initial experience, they might never get them back.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, and there's the old stat which I saw probably a year or two ago, so it might be a little bit out of date now. But the point still remains is that, you know, when it comes to user experience of an application, you try it once, doesn't work. You go, all right, fair enough. You might reinstall it. You'll try it again. If it still doesn't work, it's done forever.
Yeah, yeah.
You'll never give it another shot.
Except Tinder, I'd reload that one every time.
Well, that's another podcast entirely, isn't it?
That's another form of catching things on the street. apart from the sort of tech side of things, we've just seen people losing their mind over this game. I mean, we've seen stampedes in Central Park. We've seen people falling off cliffs playing this game. Tragically,
driving into police cars.
Yeah, parked police cars.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's incredible, just this level of pay mania that's just been going on around the place.
It's just the accumulation of these little virtual things.
Well, I think a lot of it is a throwback to, for people like me and Jamie,
we were
around the age of playing it in school with a trading card game.
Right.
Then sort of evolved onto sort of Game Boy and things like that. And then this is kind of the first time that Pokemon's been released on any sort of mobile platform. So, you know, it's a real nostalgia thing for us, and I think that explains why so many people are going just crazy for it.
And well, since it's launched, Nintendo's value has doubled.
Yeah.
One game has doubled its value from whatever, 20 billion to 40 billion.
Yeah.
Well, that's a throwback to where they were. I mean, do you remember? I mean, I think I was in year 6 or year 7 when it came out.
Yeah.
And, you know, you had the cartoon series with Ash as well, and then the trading games, and then the Game Boy. I remember you used to wander around the playground just face glued to a Game Boy for 15, 20 minutes.
Well, all over again.
Well, now we're at the same stage. Yeah, that's happening again. I can imagine in school playgrounds at the moment, there's just hundreds of children with their phone out bumping into each other, mindlessly wandering around the playground, not talking to each other.
And we're already getting people buying like Pokemon accounts for thousands of dollars of real money.
Wow.
I always find it fascinating when you get this intersection between virtual goods and real goods, and people paying real money for virtual stuff.
It's a massive thing. I mean, I used to be a self-confessed World of Warcraft player, and that's got a big old sort of currency exchange thing going on, you know, where you can spend real money for in-game gold. And
well, there's an interesting thing. So are you still a big World of Warcraft player?
No.
So what made you stop?
I then got a girlfriend and a life.
Yeah. I see. So it's getting a life.
Sorry to any World of Warcraft players, because I do feel for you guys.
Fair enough.
They need Tinder. That's what I mean.
Right, okay. So let's segue into a story which I wrote up today, last Thursday, a few months ago, depending on when you're listening to this, is that Android is dominating iOS for mobile gaming downloads, according to gaming engine Unity.
Right.
And it's a pretty linear kind of story. It's basically saying that Android has got more downloads of its games than iOS, but that kind of makes sense because Android's bigger than iOS. But I mean, it's a pretty significant. Market share leaders got over it. Something like 82% of all of the downloads on Unity's platform have come from Android. And just to put it into context, Unity is the platform on which something like 250,000 games, mobile games, have been built, which are available. And it's had 4.4 billion game downloads on 1.2 or 1.3 billion devices worldwide.
Okay.
So it's a pretty statistically relevant, significant number. But I'm going to just pitch to you guys, hopefully you haven't seen my prompt sheet. Which three countries, we like playing to get a bit of guessing game here, don't we? So, which three countries have seen Android gain more than 90% market share for downloads?
Which three countries?
There are four, but I'm looking for the top three.
China?
Nope.
The UK?
Absolutely not.
No, the UK is quite a big Apple one. There's some other European, like Italy or Spain, they're quite big on Android.
No, I'll push you guys in the right direction. They're all largely classified as emerging markets.
Oh, I see. We've got to guess.
Brazil?
Yep, Brazil's one of them.
India?
Absolutely. India's the second one. You're on a roll. Third one.
Russia?
No, afraid
not. He went for the BRICS.
Colombia? Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying Brazil, Indonesia?
Yes, absolutely. One of the most surprisingly densely populated places in the world. Fourth one, just going to put it out there. Where would you expect Android to be particularly large?
Antarctica.
That's just either take the game seriously or don't play at all. I'm sorry. unsurprisingly, it's Korea. Because Samsung's absolute dominance in Korea. Yeah. Apple has only one, let's say it, win in the top 10 countries in the world. So which do we think that would
US.
Be? No. No. UK. Another one of Apple's major sort of dedicated markets.
Japan?
Yeah. So a lot of people over there playing Pokemon Go on iPhones.
Right, there we go.
Well, not quite yet.
No, that's true. No, you're right. Maybe, depending on when people are listening to it. We can keep falling back to this. This paradox.
We're ruining the magic.
Okay, so let's move on from there and just start hitting a couple of the a couple of the sort of long taily bits that we do at the end of the show then. So first one is that Corning, who do a lot of sort of glass manufacturing,
they're the main glass
scoops and whatnot, are due to release Gorilla 5. This is something I read on The Verge. It was a really good article by Lauren Good, who does a lot of the writing for The Verge. Basically, they have increased the survivability of their glass screens when dropped from waist or shoulder height. So one of the classic problems that we get with screens is, as everyone knows or has experienced, I have not yet, I'll knock on wood for that one, is, you know, that dreaded moment where you drop your smartphone and it crunches onto the hard marble floor.
And then you've got to go around with this knackered looking phone for ages.
So basically what Corning have done is that they've designed this new 0.6 of a millimetre thick pane of glass, which can sit over the smartphone of future generations, and has an 80% survivability rate when dropped from over 1.6 metres, which is pretty sizable.
Looks like they'll keep their strong position then.
So I'm a bit sceptical at that. You know, you could drop it and then it breaks and then just go, you're in the 20%, or you're in the 20%, and then the next person says,
I think they have to be able to back up that claim. I don't think they can just wildly say all of them are going to be great, or 99.9% are fine.
But I mean, it's one of those mathematical things that it's not 80% of screens survive. It's every time you drop it, it's 80% likely that it will survive. So turns around, you could just go, you're in that 20%. You were in that 20%.
But if you're not, then you'll be happy, right?
Yeah. You're laughing.
What happens when you drop your phone, Jay?
Have you ever tried to destroy a Nokia? Absolutely no chance.
When he drops his phone, the pavement cracks.
The room shakes.
all very good stuff. So a little quirk of the week we came across here was office workers' use of social media. So we've heard a lot of stuff in the press over the last sort of couple of years about mainly sort of teachers or people in a position of responsibility sort of being done by their employer for putting things they shouldn't be putting on social media.
There's a lot of reckless use of social media.
Yeah, let's put it that way. And then, so a survey was done in which 2,000 respondents stated what they would and would not put on social media. So 10% of people don't think the stuff they put on social media will get them into trouble.
Right.
Which is relatively fair enough. I think the most of us sat here would be fine.
Depending
on what you put on there. Yeah, of course. So, but it's strictly in trouble with their employer.
Let's put it this way.
So it also depends on whether you have your boss on Facebook.
Which is a bit of a schoolboy error, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I do have my boss on Facebook. So 24% of the respondents said that they would consider posting photos of them on or using or near drugs on social media.
Right.
That's 24% said they'd consider it.
Right.
14% actually have. Yeah.
It's quite a lot, isn't it?
Depends on the drug as well, doesn't it?
Indeed.
Let's not go down that road.
Yeah, indeed.
51% said they'd do the same for alcohol.
Well, I was going to ask, does that include alcohol? It obviously doesn't.
No, they've classified this separately, yeah. 51% said they would post pictures of themselves drunk or drinking alcohol. I mean, I don't really get the stigma behind that. 34% have. I'm certainly in that 34%.
Right. Does that count just sort of at a pub, or is this properly sort of out of it, 4 in the morning?
Yeah,
job?
I mean, it depends. I mean, if it's sort of like the deepest, darkest depths of a stag do, then that's the sort of thing you probably wouldn't put on social media. But
although you're probably so drunk that you'd think it was a good idea at the time.
Probably, yeah. Incidentally, just a little fun fact, Facebook Messenger's just hit 1 billion monthly mobile users, so congrats to those guys.
Skeptical again. They don't allow you to choose. I was moaning about this to you today. So it's all well and good saying, "Oh, you've hit 1 billion users,"
but you got to.
It's not a choice. You know, Facebook are telling you.
Yeah.
You have to download.
It's not even like those Windows 10 ones where every time I turn on my PC, I get this nagging.
Yeah.
To upgrade to Windows 10, which I still haven't done.
It's like that. It's like that little paperclip that turns up. It's just like, no, go away.
Paperclip. It's just like, no, showing your age there, Jamie.
I see you're trying to access some messages. Would you like to download our app? And no, but I mean, you can see that one of two ways, can't you? You can see that as being either we've got this new application and we want people to use it. So if people want to use messages on Facebook, then they use this app. Kind of makes sense. It does also force them down this road where they have to use the Messenger application if they want to use messages. I don't know about the intricacies of the app's performance, so I don't know if the Facebook app wasn't really performing very well because they had this sort of Messenger thing also wedged in there, and they kind of, you know, separated them so that they could improve the performance of the Facebook app.
But it's kind of like, I mean, the one thing that grates me is that they put out this this press release saying, look at us, aren't we great, you know, slap us on the back. And you're like, well, you forced a billion people to do it. Well, well done.
I'm sure it wasn't at gunpoint, though, to be fair.
Well, no, if you haven't tried, you can't look at your Facebook messages unless you have it dilutes it. I think it throws it out the window.
Right, okay, sorry. There was I being all moderate.
Okay, so for British people who recall the pre-smartphone era, I mean, there's a lot of them.
Why are you looking at me?
Because you're the oldest one here. It is a very nostalgic moment for these guys as well. The speaking clock, BT's famous speaking clock, is 80 years old.
Which is even older than me.
Just.
Yeah.
I'll take that back. 80 years old, that is.
Speaking clock.
Yeah, happy birthday. Actually, it's called Tim. It's known as Tim. Because the three letters that you dial in would be T-I-M.
Have a cake with a stupid amount of candles on it.
Thanks. Congrats to the talking clock. We have, just before we go, had a user comment from no other than my very own brother, my kin. All right, Greg, got your tweet here. It said, in reference to last week's episode on the of IoT.
Right.
Driverless cars, grimacing emoji, I'll have to put value on life. This is written in a very strict 140 character limit, so it's quite tough to get through. So start again. Driverless cars, ? Grimacing emoji, it'll have to put a value on life. If a kid runs in front, does it swerve to hit a dog / a wall and kill you / hit the kid? ? So let's play a game of hit the dog, a wall, and kill yourself, or hit the kid.
Can I just sort of slightly graze the dog, but otherwise be all right?
Should we just, in hindsight, just not play this game?
What sort of dog are we talking about?
This is just going to be a very macabre, unsettling game.
Is it one of those little ones that you see carried around in a purse on the tube?
Because right.
In his 140 characters, my dearest brother didn't
have
the opportunity
to specify. Can we invite Greg to elaborate then?
Greg, drop us your thoughts. We'll discuss this again next week, but preferably with not such a grimacing, horrible set of choices. Anyway, on that absolute clanger, it's time for us to go and jump in our cars and take ourselves away. So it's goodbye from me, Tim Skinner. It's goodbye from Scott Buccino.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from Jamie Davies.
Thanks, Tim.
See you later, gang. Thanks very much for joining us. This has been A Week in Wireless, the podcast brought to you by telecoms.com, covering everything and anything in the telecoms industry. If you want to join the argument, tweet us at Telecoms. Share your thoughts. We'll see you again next week. Same place, same time, same people, but even better.